I think we're extremely lucky in having Rob Wainwright here. I've known him for a few years now. I can't think of anyone better qualified to speak on this subject. I think most of you got a CV. Have you, most of you seen a CV? If you haven't, from about 1989 onwards, he worked for 10 years as an intelligence analyst in fields of counter-terrorism and organised crime. Between 2000 and 2003, he was head of the UK Liaison Bureau at Europol. In 2003, he was promoted to position of Director International of the National Criminal Intelligence Service, the NCIS. Between 2006 and 2009, he was Chief of the International Department of the UK Serious Organised Crime Agency, SOCA. He was appointed Director of Europol in April 2009, which I think when we first met, just shortly after that. And he was reappointed for a second term in 2013. So, as I say, I can't think of anyone better qualified to speak to us this afternoon. Of course, it's a highly pertinent time to be talking about this after the attacks in Paris, with the problems within Belgium and indeed across Europe. I see he was born in 1967, which was the first year I shot a terrorist, so I'm feeling very old now. It's interesting that in the early 2000s, I don't think most of Europe really saw the threat from terrorism in the same way as we did in this country, and they thought this was a sort of British problem, rather as the Americans did. The only ones, I suppose, who were different from that were the French, who had given us warning in the mid-90s. And I think that was quite interesting, but now they realise this is all pervasive, this threat, and it's causing them huge problems. I think another interesting aspect is the issue of foreign policy. I don't know if you're going to touch on it. How much does that impact on radicalisation? Tony Blair always said it didn't at all. I have to say I felt that it did. But not as much as is said. There is no doubt that Al-Qaeda and terrorists were trying to kill us well before we went into Afghanistan in 1998, when I was CDI, we unravelled a plot to poison the North London water supplies with ricin. If they'd done it, they'd have killed probably several hundred thousand people. And they were doing that before we were invading anywhere. So it's not a direct linkage. A number of questions were emailed in the invitation that was sent. I won't go through them all, a whole number of issues that are fascinating, which I'm sure, Rob, you've had a look at, and you may be able to answer some of them. And I think without further ado, welcome, and we look forward to 30 minutes from you and then some questions.
Thank you very much. Yes, indeed. It was about 6 years ago, Admiral, I think, when we first met, and as a Home Office Minister, you helped to arm wrestle a few European partners to make sure that they voted for me when I was applying for the job of Director of Europol. So
we have ways of doing that.
To a certain extent, I wouldn't be here today if it wasn't for your support and many, many others. So I have been the Director of Europol for the last 6 years and seen the evolution, in fact, the globalisation of security threats affecting the UK and other member states over that time, and a mini transformation, I'd say, in the nature of the international terrorist threat into one that is today, I think, a particularly aggressive new brand of international terrorism that threatens us at least as severely as anything we've seen since 9/11, in my view. So I'm going to talk you through over the next 25 minutes, perhaps, of the way that how I think that threat presents itself. For those of you not familiar with Europol, I wouldn't blame you for not being so. We're not Interpol, we're something very different. We specialise much more in high-end analytical work, intelligence sharing across borders in the European Union, in particular targeting the top end of crime, including terrorism. And we're not a European FBI either. We have no police powers at all. Instead, to use a very modern business jargon analogy, we're part of what is effectively the platform economy, in the sense that if you think that Uber has become the largest taxi company in the world and doesn't own a single vehicle, Airbnb, the largest accommodation provider in the world and doesn't own a single property, Europol has become a leading law enforcement institution in the world. We don't have a single police power, and we don't own our own original intelligence at all. Instead, we provide a technology-enabled platform that now connects over 650 law enforcement agencies right across Europe and beyond, and that is exchanging thousands of messages every day of a sensitive nature relating to ongoing casework against some of the most dangerous criminal and terrorist groups in Europe. And critically, at our headquarters, at the hub of this vast information network, we apply the power of data analytics, as the American would call it. So we have large teams of analysis that are they're interrogating those data flows every day to try and find the connections that are increasing, of course, in a cross-border nature between criminals and terrorists operating in different European jurisdictions. Increasing investment of the US in our agency. We have 12 federal agencies with attaches now in our community, and they've seen, I think, that Europol can act as a very important pivot for Europe as a whole, and they're investing large-scale in our institution because of that. Those Americans, by the way, are part of a 200-strong community of police attaches drawn from 40 countries that take our analysis feeds every day, take our expertise, and convert that into operational effects. So we don't have the operational powers, but they are coordinating amongst themselves using our capabilities in around 35,000 to 40,000 cross-border cases a year, and therefore bringing about the disruptions and arrests of criminals and terrorists. We channel our work really in three priority areas at the moment, many others as well, but three top priority areas of migration, terrorism and cyber. And in each of those areas, provided more specific, more operationally focused versions of that platform. So 2 years ago, we launched the European Cybercrime Centre, which brings task force of experts together, intensifies the information exchange, turns that around into investigations every day. We've repeated the formula we're about to on migration, about to launch European Migration Smuggling Centre, and just 2 weeks ago I've done the same on terrorism. So for the first time now in Europe, we have a dedicated European Counterterrorism Centre in this most sensitive policy area, of course. Ministers were convinced of the need to do that after the attacks that we saw last year, as you recall, starting with Charlie Hebdo and ending in even more spectacular terms in Paris at the end of the year. So what ministers saw from that was an escalating nature of the threat and the need, therefore, not to create a European FBI or a CIA, far from it, but to provide a better means by which we can exchange information, coordinate investigations and provide a higher level of expertise in the critical areas of tracking the flows of terrorist finance, terrorist firearms, and of course the way in which IS and other groups are operating online as using the internet especially as a recruitment and propaganda instrument. So the threat I talked about earlier, of course, we've had a significant threat from international terrorism for many years. You all know that already. And even before the events in November, I think Europol and others were talking about an enhanced threat, recognising that, in particular, this phenomenon of the travelling foreign fighters was alarming, that we have 5,000 European nationals, at least, that have been radicalised, normally on the internet, and then by conflict experience in Syria and Iraq, many of whom have since returned to Europe with the intent, if not the capability, to carry out the kind of attacks that we've seen. And then a whole series of so-called lone actor attacks, including a Jewish centre in Brussels on the Thalys train, Charlie Hebdo and so on, and has become a mainstay of the terrorist threat that we're currently facing, I think, in Europe as well. A certain escalating rivalry between IS and Al-Qaeda, perhaps, for some kind of Champions League battle of who can be the most damaging and effective international terrorist group. The increasing radicalisation within some of the most vulnerable sections of our community. These are all trends that we were seeing. And certainly growing links between crime and terrorism, especially in relation to the provision of firearms, including AK-47s, for example, from the criminal underworld seeping into the hands of terrorists. So all of this has been known for some time and has been of major concern to us. Paris, though, added a new dimension to that, of course, because it was the first time that we saw a Mumbai-style attack in Europe. In 2008, that was something that shocked the world at the time in India. And now on the streets of Europe, for the first time really in that form, in that coordinated form, we had indiscriminate public shootings, suicide belts, and something which clearly was a statement of intent by IS to go much more global, much more aggressive and damaging, I think, in their international threat, and really a shift away from the lone actor threat to something that we have seen in the past, of course, with Al-Qaeda, which was the work of a well-planned, well-coordinated network of terrorists, some 9 or 10, that had carried out those attacks. And if you look at the videos, of course, that have been released before and since then, a clear statement of intent. And if you look also at the actions that there have been that have been attributed to IS in the Sinai with the Russian airliner, some other major attacks in Turkey, in the Lebanon, for example, then it seems a marked shift by IS to go more global. And that, of course, is something that concerns us. And in the wake of the Paris attacks, we convened at Europol some leading experts from many national administrations for a particular look at that question. How different is the threat from IS now? What does Paris really tell us about it? And they come up with a very interesting report, which a public version of which we released at the time we launched the new European Counterterrorism Centre. And it identified what was already known in the intelligence community, of course, but not so well publicly known, that indeed IS have developed a special forces style external command force that would specifically train and plan the kind of attacks that we saw in Paris. Many other aspects about how IS are recruiting from our communities. Importantly, that the band of foreign fighters that we're dealing with seem to be, including the suicide bombers, seem to be motivated less by religious zeal, perhaps as we might have attributed to Al-Qaeda in the past, and more by social elements such as role modelling and peer pressure. And with the suicide bombers, have seen themselves less as religious martyrs and more as military heroes. And I think that's a slightly different persona around the members of that organisation that we're dealing with, and that's important for us to recognise, I think. A lot of them with mental health problems, up to 20%. A lot of them, many of them, with criminal backgrounds, and this is very important to understand, I think, in terms of evolving our response to this threat, in the sense that much more than ever before, information about the activities of these people will be found in more everyday, more traditional police databases, perhaps about their criminal background in the drug sector or acquiring firearms or something else. And that's important for us, therefore, to connect information exchange, intelligence exchange, in a much wider environment than some of the traditional data sets of the intelligence world. And that's a point, I think, that has been recognised by ministers in particular as a so-called lesson learned from Paris, which was perhaps information exchange can still improve a bit further. But even before the events in Paris, and following Charlie Hebdo in particular, there was an escalation of course, political interest in this issue. A new dynamic, I think, was created in a way that we hadn't seen before at the European level. And the EU Justice and Home Affairs ministers had decided on fairly far-reaching conclusions, including some that I'll come on to in a minute, about how we're tackling the online threat. Of course, that was intensified by what happened in Paris, and then we switched, therefore, to the rather immediate launch of this European Counterterrorism Centre in January. And it tries, and again, it doesn't, as I said, provide in any way a replacement for what is still, I think, very well-functioning intelligence cooperation across Europe. But instead tries to provide a complementary platform, complementary way, trying to coordinate a better police counter-terrorist response alongside what the intelligence agencies are doing themselves. And critically, if we can get this right, a bridge across, particularly in terms of information exchange. Not automatic, not necessarily wholesale, but in those cases where it most needs it. And those are the discussions that I'm having with the heads of those agencies right now as to whether or not we can build that kind of system that gives confidence and trust to that community and the special and very important work that they do, but still gives them the need also to access perhaps a broader information terrain. So we will be providing this platform essentially to increase information. That's the first priority, really, to try and provide a better means by which we can share the national counter-terrorist police authorities, especially to exchange better levels of information. And for that, we're upgrading parts of our system, so our so-called Siena platform, which connects these 650 agencies around Europe, now has a dedicated compartment just for terrorism, which is about to be upgraded also to a more highly secure format. And so we are trying to build better levels of security capability to give that trust and, of course, to allow us to deal with more sensitive information as well. And already 26 of the 28 member states are connected to that specific counter-terrorist data set that I talked about. Of course, that information exchange should allow us to have a more powerful data analytical capability, and that's, you know, very much the meat and drink of the work that Europol does. We have a database that specifically holds information relating to suspected foreign fighters, so that we can compare the lists between different countries, of course, but perhaps more importantly, to check if some of those names and suspects and their associates have any links into the more traditional police databases that I talked about. The extent of Europol's capability and information access to data on drug trafficking, on people smuggling, on money laundering, for example, is sizable. And making sure that, therefore, that we can connect all of that massive data with some terrorist suspects, I think, is something that is of high priority. So encouraging member states to share with us, therefore, their data on foreign fighters, and not just member states, many other international actors that are sharing data with us. And we have 18,000 names of suspected foreign fighters and their contacts and associates in that database, not all of whom are confirmed foreign fighters, and certainly not all of whom are European nationals, but a significant body of them indeed are. A big push on trying to increase the amount of intelligence exchange on firearms supply, as I said earlier, from the criminal underworld as well. Around 600 cases live at the moment across the criminal sector in particular, not all of whom will have criminal dimensions, but a significant increase in work in that area. The structure of the centre, I'll talk a little bit later about some work we're doing on financing as well and on monitoring the internet. But the structure, that's the boring bit. I won't talk so much about that. Suffice to say, we have no operational powers per se. We have a very experienced senior counter-terrorist officer from Spain who's leading that new centre. We're having an uplift in our budgetary resources at a difficult time in the EU, but still only 40 or 50 people or so, which is likely to more or less double over the course of the next 2 years, we hope. So that's the kind of position that we're in. Those figures, though, I think are a bit of a red herring, because the whole point of what we're doing at Europol is to leverage a much broader overall community response by operating as this platform, so that we can connect, therefore, hundreds if not thousands of other detectives around that hub in the way that it works. There are, of course, many information systems available across Europe. I talked about the intelligence world. There are many in the EU, like the Schengen Information System and other bespoke databases on visas, on fingerprints and so on. And all of that is not joined up either. And it's an interesting, you know, the reason for that actually is not necessarily that it's been technically difficult. It's actually designed that way. You know, it's lawmakers in Europe have on purpose ensured that these different data sets shall not be joined into a single superstate system. Because of data protection sensitivities. And the debate between privacy and security in large parts of other parts of Europe is very different to how it often is in the UK. And in particular, the Parliament is quite a feisty guardian of data privacy issues and indeed justice issues. And, you know, fights its corner pretty well, actually. And, you know, I understand the very important dynamic of getting the balance right between security and justice, and it's played out right now in every country, including in the UK, of course, in terms of the investigatory powers and the legislation that would be debated. That is important, but very often I think in Europe the balance is tilted a bit more to the other side. And there's a very, I think, simple reason for that. Security issues in the European debate are reserved at the national level. And so there isn't a locus, there isn't a competence, and therefore not a natural interest for European lawmakers to discuss that issue, whereas data protection issues and others are. And I think over many, many years, therefore, that's built up a different kind of culture around the understanding of these issues. Now, events such as we saw in Paris, of course, helped to shape the political dynamic in a certain way, and then you see the same sort of pendulum swing that you see perhaps in any country. But at the moment, I think that's a very important cultural and indeed legal issue that we face in Europe. Well, of course, what Paris also showed was that there was a lot of work now to be done in investigating what actually happened in the run-up to that investigation and what lessons we can learn from that. And in what was a bit of a sea change step, actually, Europol has been asked to provide a central role in helping to analyse that case in a way that we've never been given before. Never before has Europol been given such an important frontline role in helping to investigate such a major terrorist attack in Europe. The French authorities decided in this case to do that because of certain support we could give immediately, particularly from on the financial intelligence front. We seconded officers to their operational control room on day one or day two, and the French prosecutor has since officially mandated Europol to analyse the whole criminal case, and we've received enormous quantities of data and have now a 30-man and woman team investigating that case. And again, it's likely to be a very important development, I think, in Europol's competence, growing up perhaps as a trusted partner in the EU community, because other member states may follow, and at least it will store in Europol's database this very rich data set about these 9 or 10 suspects and their associates that were behind the Paris attack, and you can imagine how important that might be in the coming years as we face other threats as well. Terrorist financing has always been a very important part of the work that Europol has done, and about 5 years ago, in 2010, we were given a very specific mandate to help facilitate the implementation of a new EU-US terrorist financing tracking program. Politically sensitive, again, especially in the Parliament, nonetheless has turned into what the Americans would describe as to be one of the most important counter-terrorist instruments that they use anywhere in their system. And it's generated, since 2010, some 18,000 or 19,000 specific financial intelligence leads relating to international terrorism. So the volume of this is significant, is impressive, and often yielding intelligence that is unique, i.e. not coming from other sources. So Europol's role is, first of all, somehow a semi-legal role in validating the request that the US have to this sensitive, if not bulk data, in Europe. And they're also acting as a central mechanism for coordinating European police interest in accessing this very rich database that is under the supervision of the US Department of Treasury. So lots of requests flowing to and from, generating those intelligence leads that I talked about. Around 3,000 of which, by the way, specifically relate to the activities and movements of foreign fighters. It's a very, very important part of the work. And only in the context of the Paris investigation, we were able to provide the French with 1,600 financial intelligence leads in that case. So it's something that can be highly relevant and very timely. Just as important, I think, is the work that we do in monitoring IS activity and other groups online. Of course, Al-Qaeda has established an online presence for many years, of course, but what we've seen, I think, through the development of IS is a shift away from the kind of broadcast model of Al-Qaeda to something that's much more targeted as a recruitment tool, but also in terms of one message being multiplied many, many times across the social media, which is penetrating, therefore, a much larger share, a much bigger part of our community, and I think it's been effective for them and one very challenging aspect of the work that we do. Until recently, Europol's work had been to monitor the so-called jihadist websites, which in itself has been and continues to be important. But really, the response now is to try and deal with the fact that IS is so active across the social media domain. Of course, there's been some very good national responses to this, including here in the UK, where the Metropolitan Police has established an internet referral unit, some of you will be very familiar with. And after Charlie Hebdo in particular, crystallised the minds of ministers in Europe to establish a European equivalent of that. And so on the 1st of July last year, we launched a six-month pilot project in Europe to try and create a European internet referral unit, borrowing a lot of the best practice from the UK and one or two other countries, and to put in place centralised arrangements on behalf of all 28 member states in terms of working with social media platform providers in monitoring and then the taking down of these websites. Important again that we were given no enforceable powers at all. And it's all we are doing essentially is helping those social media companies enforce their own terms of service. That's all we're doing. The final decision always rests with them. But of course, as Twitter announced just 2 days ago, they have a very firm policy around this and want to remove that terrorist content as much as possible. Indeed, they published the fact that they removed 125,000 accounts that can be attributed to IS within the last year. And that shows you the scale of the response from Twitter, which is commendable, and indeed many, many other social media platform providers, but it also tells you something about the scale of the threat that we're facing, because those are by no means the only ones that are still out there. And I think, in particular, what we're facing is something that's characterised by resilience, because there are dispersed networks of accounts, not only on Twitter, of course, deliberately dispersed across the 20-plus different social media platforms that we have. That it works in a fairly organic way. It kind of automatically can reinvent itself in other places when you do take something down. Extremely difficult to deal with. The speed of it, just how quickly the messages that get out and how they sort of spread like wildfire. The first 2 hours after Paris attacks, for example, the hashtag ParisBurning was tweeted and retweeted 7,500 times every 15 minutes. And 1 million views of around 15 or 17 videos that we had identified online, which were celebrating effectively the attacks in Paris. In May 2014, a video of an execution got 57,000 views within the first 24 hours and so on. So, you know, the speed of this and just the scale of it is enormous, frankly, and of course particularly challenging to those of us who are trying to do something about it. So it's almost impossible to play the numbers game around this, of course, and instead what we're trying to do is try to combine our knowledge of this space with the other intelligence that we have to get a better understanding of how this so-called terrorist ecosystem online works. And we've been able to identify some nodal accounts that have a particularly disproportionate impact on the problem. It could be automatic translation accounts so that the message gets translated into 12 other European languages automatically. Or they could be the way in which IS is increasingly using cybercrime techniques to propagate their messaging and their communication model, in particular the use of botnet technology, for example, which allows them to remotely infect and take control of host computers in very high numbers. So, you know, if we can identify those and take those out, then we will have more of a strategic impact on the problem. Absolutely rely on the cooperation with those social media companies. And in that six-month period, I think we identified some 2,000 or so, with an 88% hit rate. It would have been much higher, but in one particular area where material is archived on the internet, there is a different set of principles that are at play, which is around the fact that something should be archived online for future research. So there's a different debate to be had specifically in that area. But in the in the other areas of Twitter and YouTube and so on, and Facebook, you know, we're in the sort of high 90% in terms of the success rate that we have. So we can achieve close to 100% of what we think is dangerous and damaging without having any enforceable powers. And it says something, I think, in this climate of a rather zero-sum game between privacy advocates on one side and security on the other, tech firms on one side, police on the other. Actually, there is still a lot to be gained from mutual cooperation. And that's what we've effectively found in this space as well. And I just wondered to what extent we've fully exhausted that in terms of the encryption debate as well. Well, that's a much wider issue, of course. Okay, so I think my time's almost up, Admiral. So let me just conclude by saying that what we're seeing is a more globalized threat, as I said earlier, particularly in the way in which these groups are using technology, particularly in the more rapid-fire movement of this dispersed community across European borders, making some, if not yet, systematic use of the migration routes and crisis that befell Europe as well last year. A deliberate strategy by IS to step up and go more global, with a particular focus, I think, on attacking Europe as well. Using people that have some criminal antecedents, information about which, therefore, is held in a wider information environment. And those are putting particular stresses, therefore, on the more traditional ways of countering terrorism. And therefore, we all need to up our game and respond, and we need to do more international police cooperation, of course, but also more intelligence sharing. Very importantly, that has to be as much the case in the intelligence world as it is in the police world. Europol's role is not to replace the former, but of course to complement it as well, and it's sometimes a sensitive, if not febrile, debate, but one that is beginning to show signs of a more constructive atmosphere, certainly since the events of November the 13th in particular. So I think this is still a very threatening time. The last video from IS you will have seen made particular references to the UK as well as to France. I think, as Andrew Parker and many others have said, and his equivalents around Europe, the likelihood of another major attack in Europe is still high. And the things that I've touched about today are part of, I think, Europe's response to dealing with it. I think that's probably enough for now.
Thank you very much indeed.